This is the second time. Last year I did a Thursday night talk and a Saturday day-long retreat, and it was really wonderful. I love the Theosophical Society. When my teacher, Bhante Sujatha, had his very first weekend retreats back in 2000, maybe 2005 or 6, they were here. And he's from Sri Lanka, so all the other monks at our temple are from Sri Lanka. And the Theosophical Society has a very important role in the Buddhist history in Sri Lanka, because Colonel Alcott went to Sri Lanka and revived Buddhism, where it had been pretty much destroyed, other than kind of secretly and out in the jungles, by the British colonialism. And they revived Buddhism in Sri Lanka, and he's a national hero. And I think Colonel Alcott also created the Buddhist flag. So the Theosophical Society is very important in modern Buddhist history. So we have a great deal of respect and fondness for the Theosophical Society. How many of you are regular meditators in any tradition? Okay, that's over half the people. And how many of you are completely new, just kind of interested, curious? Okay, good. So whether you're new or whether you're practitioners, I may speak to something that's new to you or different from your tradition. So we'll talk, and then we will do meditation, and then we'll have questions and answers. So if there are things that are very different from your own practice, we can talk about that during the discussion. So hopefully there'll be something new or something controversial, so you can get excited about that. When we talk about the compulsive thinking mind, I love something that I read recently in Noah Levine's book, and he's with Against the Stream and has written several books. Have any of you heard of him? He's a younger Buddhist teacher, and he actually has started a 12-step recovery group. So at our temple now, we have one of the refuge recovery groups, and that has been a really wonderful addition to the activities at our temple. But he talks about thinking as an addiction. And I think that's so wonderful, because the recovery group is open to anyone. And anyone who comes just kind of defines what the issue they may be working on. And so people will come, and they haven't ever been to a 12-step group, but they know that there are things that they want to work on, whether they're Buddhist or not. And so they can always say, I'm a recovering thinker. You know? I have an addiction to thinking. And I think all of us are that way. And that's one of the things the Buddha really talked about a lot, is that we depend on our thinking mind, and we create problems in our life because of the way we think, and then we try to solve the problems by thinking about them. So we're using the wrong tool, you know, where our thinking mind is going to probably create more problems rather than solve problems. And meditation is a tool that we can use to get around that thinking mind that's so busy trying to fix everything and solve everything. When we learn to meditate, we're trying to learn how to work with that mind and kind of get somewhere deeper than the mind, where we can have insight about the right paths we need to take and decisions we need to make. So we're never we're learning how to be in harmony with our minds, but not control our minds. It's never good to talk about controlling our mind, because as soon as we do, the mind is going to try to show us how wrong we are. But we can, it's almost like taming a horse, a rider and a horse. We're learning how to how to work with our minds. But a lot of times that means bypassing our thinking, because our thinking is crazy. And our thinking, the monkey mind is a beautiful image of it. That's like a monkey swinging from vine to vine. Whenever we sit down and we get quiet, especially if we're meditating, we suddenly find that our mind wants to jump. That monkey wants to just swing from one limb to another, and we can in a second be off in our own movie, in our past, in our future, solving our problems, going over and over and over again with the same issues that we've gone over a million times. And when we're meditating, what we do is just stop and observe that. And most people in the world have never meditated, so they've never had a chance to really see how that monkey mind works. So there, we often think about, if you do meditate, think about your mind before you ever practiced. Most of the time, our whole day is spent just following the monkey, chasing after the monkey. So our whole day we may have planned out, but then our thoughts start taking us from one thing to another, and before we know it, the day's over and we've done a whole bunch of stuff, but none of it was what we had intended to do. It's just, we've just been swinging from the trees. So our whole life can be that way. And a practice like meditation is a way to overcome always being at the mercy of that monkey mind. We know it's good for us. We know it feels good. We know we really have the intention to do it, but we don't have it in our daily, it's not a habit. We don't have it as a daily discipline. And so we go for long periods and then we come back to it and go away. I'm really lucky and blessed to be part of Blue Lotus Temple. So we have a location, we have a temple, and it's just beautiful. People who walk into it just immediately feel peaceful and it feels good. But even with that temple, and even with people who live near enough, within 45 minutes of Woodstock, who come on a regular basis and with several meditations during the week, people still have a problem making it part of their personal routine at home. And we're always encouraging people. The temple is a wonderful place, and we're really lucky to have it. And it's there. It's open all day. It's open most weekends. And it's there for people to come and sit and to just be. But we're always telling people at the same time, don't use the temple as a crutch, which it can be, because our practice needs to be developed in our daily lives. Because the practice, just our meditation training, then needs to grow to where we're living a meditative life. So everything we do is with mindfulness and really paying attention to what we're doing and what our intentions are, and then if we're following up with that. So if you're not lucky enough to have a temple, it's even harder to maintain a practice. So it really does have to become just part of your day. You know, you have to work it into your day. But it often can be walking. A lot of times people think that they have to sit on a cushion and have a really nice, quiet, sanctified space. And that's, most of us don't have that. So, you know, maybe we'll talk about some ideas for ways to make it daily. But for a lot of people, walking, a lot of times it's good to sit when you first wake up. And I tell people, we practice meditating lying down. Because sometimes you may have a few minutes where you have some peace and quiet before you get out of bed. And if you can do lying meditation, but being awake, not falling back asleep, then you know you've got that time, or time when you're going to bed and you finally have a little break in your day, you know, that's another time you can meditate. And if you learn to to meditate lying down without falling asleep, then you can use that time. And I always recommend to people, don't be locked rigidly into, I'm going to do it at exactly this time in the morning every day. Because first thing that will happen is that time is going to be taken away from you. And then you think, oh, my day is ruined. My day is going to be terrible. I can't sit. And you start beating on yourself about it. So if a morning is a wonderful time to sit, but if your morning is not good, or this morning is good, but somebody called and you had an emergency, then you find another time. You need to be flexible with it. And not what we're learning to do, especially in the meditation that I practice and that we'll do, we do loving kindness and vipassana or insight meditation. So we practice loving kindness to learn how to love ourselves and be friends with ourselves, because then that's what we radiate out to others, and that's how we're able to help other people. But until we love ourselves, anything we do, anything we reach out to do to help others may be kind of contaminated with our neediness or our own needs. So loving kindness, we begin by purifying our own minds, which means learning to love ourselves and let go of self-judgment and self-criticism, and let go of that need we all seem to have of fixing ourselves. Because if we're doing that to ourselves, we're doing it to others. So until we learn to accept ourselves just unconditionally the way we are in our current terrible, awful state, but accept that that's who we are at that time, then we can learn to feel that way towards other people and other beings. But we have to begin with ourselves. So if we're beating ourselves about not sitting at 6:30 every morning, that's us. That's not being kind or loving to ourselves. And that tends to be something we can do that. If you get really rigid about your meditation practice, you can make it be another thing that you punish yourself about, right? So that's what we're always trying not to do, because the main instruction when you sit to meditate is going to be to relax, relax. So it's very hard to do that if you're trying to punish yourself about something you're not doing right, or you're not doing enough, or you're not doing long enough. So if you, we always tell people at the temple, now if you come to the temple or you're in a group and you meditate together, it's wonderful because you're very unlikely to get up in the middle of meditation and go look in the refrigerator or decide you just have to make a cell phone call. So you've got the group support to just keep you anchored. And so everybody else is able to sit here. So I'm going to be able to sit here. And I might get restless, but I'd be too embarrassed to get up and walk out. And so that's wonderful. Then it becomes, if you're in a group, you come to the group and you're already relaxed because you think, I know I'm going to sit here for the 30 minutes or however long it is, because your body even knows, okay, we can relax here because we've done it before. We're with people who are all going to sit relatively still. And if I really, really have to get up, I can do it. Everybody's eyes are closed. Nobody's going to pay attention to me. But you relax. But once we get home, it seems to be a different story for everybody. We've got all of our friendly distractions, too, just kind of sitting around, laundry, cleaning that we wouldn't be doing unless we are meditating. The monkey just swings in that direction, right? Cleaning out drawers and closets, you know, got to do it right now. So if you can find a group or put together a group, that's a wonderful thing to do. And then you can even go online and find so many guided meditations that are already on great websites, which we can talk about that later too, but and I can give you some good sites. But There are so many things like that. In our Refuge Recovery group, the book that we use is called Refuge Recovery. But the back of it has so many beautiful guided meditations. The group started about two months ago, and since I'm in the group and one of the two original facilitators, it would sort of fall on me to lead the meditation. Everybody would say, well, you know, you're a professional, so you have to do that. But all I was doing was reading the meditations that are in the book, because the group has to become everybody in the group has to learn how to facilitate the group. So one night I asked someone else if they'd read, and he said yes right away. Then later he said he thought I was just going to ask him to like read the first line of it or something. But he did such a beautiful job leading it that now he's sort of become the meditation leader, and it's his voice is wonderful. It's really been good for the whole group because we all love it. And I keep saying it's wonderful for me because I just get to meditate. With the groups that when I lead meditation, a lot of people will say, oh, we want you to lead it, we want you to guide it, we like to hear your voice, and it's, you know, it kind of helps people stay anchored. But then after a while, then little by little, I like will speak less and less, and then they become really happy with the silence. What I tell people usually is it's better not to have music and things with your meditation. And then I was recommending a certain CD. I love the meditation, and then it just hit me one day, oh, there's music in that meditation. These beautiful sounds in the background. And I hadn't even thought about that. So I still like the meditation and the sounds, but I still would recommend the less you have that might, you know, you could be sitting for 30 minutes and really just listening to music. So then you're really not meditating. It's good to relax that way. There's nothing wrong with that. But what we're learning to do, what we're doing when we're meditating is we're learning to just use our breath as our anchor, just something to have as a very light focus. We could use a flower or a candle or a chair. You know, we could use anything, but our breath is always there. So we're using our breath just to have a place to come back to when we get distracted and to help us just not float away, because we don't want to float away. But then what we're really doing is just more and more observing ourselves. We begin by just observing what our breath feels like when we breathe in and out through our nose. So we just have a little task to do, which makes our mind feel a little comfortable, not totally out there being told to, you know, take a break. And we just try to pay attention to the sensations of our breath. And it's just like the sensations would be just how the air feels right around your nostrils and how it feels if the air blows over your upper lip, or just how it feels inside your nasal passages. And, you know, depending on the time of year, in the winter, it's very different from how it is in the summer. And you can become there's a lot to observe, and we breathe all the time, right? But how often are we really paying attention to exactly what those sensations are? So that's how we begin. And then more and more we begin to observe everything going on in our bodies. And we're observing how we're reacting to all of the senses coming at us. So we talk about our sense doors. And those are our physical senses, touch and taste and smell and hearing. And then also our mind is a sense organ. So our sense doors are picking up everything. And we often have no idea of the things that we're picking up all the time. And until we sit quietly and we're still, then we begin to see a little bit more how much we're being bombarded with with all of this stuff going on around us, and then our body is reacting to all of it. You know, smells can trigger can trigger memories of past experiences, and that those memories will trigger emotions, and so that can then our mind's got all kinds of stuff to work with and start thinking about, and the monkey starts going. So the more and more we can sit quietly and still, and then learn to observe all of those things going on, and how our body is, we start seeing how our body responds to our senses, and then our mind responds to the body, and it just, it's a big playhouse, a big movie theater all the time. And we're going through our typical normal day with all of that going on. And so sometimes we're not even sure what makes us, you know, go to the refrigerator and get something to eat, or what makes us be moody, or what makes us feel irritated. And it could be because we smelled something that pulled an old memory for us that we don't even realize anymore, but it brought up something, you know, something very, maybe very sad, or something that happened long ago, like maybe a funeral of a grandparent or something, the smell of the flowers at the funeral. And we don't even know, well, why am I feeling this way? I'm a little weepy, or I'm a little sad. And then we start, then those emotions might become things that we say to someone. We're feeling a little out of sorts, and so we're short with someone and say something and get in an argument with someone. And then we set off this whole, the dominoes just start falling, and we're not even aware, why did I do that? So meditation is how we can begin to see all of that happening and then learn what's, how to work with it. We start learning when maybe we feel a certain way, that might be the beginning of a certain emotion rising up in us. And we can learn to work with that. This is a personal example, so I hope it can be relevant. I'm developing macular degeneration, so my eyes are on the way out. So when I go to the specialist and I have to go for the shots, you know, about once every 6 weeks. And so they will always ask me, okay, how's your vision? And then I'll tell them exactly what I'm experiencing. And then they do their scans and stuff, and they say, that's exactly lining up with what you're telling us. And it's even helped them see that my second eye became involved. So, and it was based on my description of my experience with my vision that made them even check the other eye. So they got it at the beginning and started treating the other eye. And I was thinking about, they keep saying, man, you describe it so perfectly. You're just telling us exactly the right sort of things. And I realized, I think the reason I do that is because of my meditation practice. So it's very easy for me. I'm seeing changes in my eyes and in my vision. And I'm so used to trying to pay attention to what's going on and sitting and trying to just be aware of that it's made it be very helpful for the treatment of my eyes, because there's no reason I should be that good at describing it. I mean, there's nothing, I'm not an artist or that, but I can really describe it, and I'm sure it's because of my meditation practice. So that's the kind of thing that will begin to happen when you sit, when you're with yourself more. And because we're being quieter, we're paying more attention, we're really more aware of what's going on in our world. There's one thing working with difficult emotions. And have any of you read Tara Brach's books or listened to her speak? Radical Acceptance is her the first book of hers I read, and she's a Buddhist teacher. She's a lay person, and she's the head of the founder and the head of the Insight Society group in Washington, D.C., and a psychotherapist, and she's a great writer and speaker. So if you go on YouTube, you can just look up Tara Brach and listen to her talks from the Insight Society. But the book Radical Acceptance is a great book to read. And she's talking about, the whole book is based on that thing that we do in meditation that we're learning, which is to totally accept ourselves the way we are now. Not to wish we were something different or sort of not like something about ourselves, so we pretend it's not a quality we have, or we just, I don't want to be like that, so I'm not going to pay attention to it, and to see other people that way too. Accept what's right in front of us. Accept reality the way it is. And then we can begin to see how we can transform ourselves by working with our mind. But we can only do it when we are really ready to say, this is me, this is who I am, and I accept that. And we know that our true nature is perfection. Our true nature, sometimes we call it Buddha nature or our spirit. We may call it our soul. But we know that the real being, the real whoever we are, is already perfectly fine and okay. But this outside thing that we're wearing around, you know, this personality and everything else, falls short of the mark for what we want, out of ourselves, right? So in Radical Acceptance and in everything she writes about, and this is very, very Buddhist, is to first acknowledge ourselves the way we are. And then that's the only possibility we have to really truly transform ourselves and to just, you know, move forward on our path. So there's something that she talks about in Radical Acceptance, and it's written about other places, but it's called RAIN. It's an acronym, R-A-I-N. The R stands for the recognition. So it's recognizing. And this is how she suggests we work with strong emotions, or strong feelings, or difficult issues and things that we're dealing with ourselves. So say we're working with emotions that we feel overpowered by. The first thing is to recognize it, and that's often the last thing we want to do. You know, we think I'm really behaving badly, but we don't want to see that. Or maybe we feel out of control, or we're thinking, ugh, what's going on with me? But I'll just go eat something, or I'll go read a book, or go to a movie, or go shopping, or just get away from all these people, they're so awful, or I'll go on a retreat, and then it'll go away, and I'll be better when I come back, or after I bought something or done something, you know. And what we don't want to do is deal with whatever that stuff was that was coming up. So we have to recognize it. And then the A stands for acknowledging it. Now this is part of that acknowledgement. This is part of that radical. This is that radical acceptance. So we have to acknowledge not only is this a strong emotion, but this is me. This is my experience, and I own it, and maybe it's been around for a long time. Then the I stands for investigate. And the way she talks about investigation is what's really wonderful. So the investigation is in meditation, and it's not with our thinking. It's not our thinking mind. So when I've talked to people about this before, I found some old notes from years ago, and it was all about RAIN, and then I was just reading some newer material. But the biggest note I had from years ago, it said, "Don't use the thinking mind," And I found that that's the most helpful thing to tell people. So we're investigating, this is how we can deal with problems without using the thing that made the problem in the first place. So we're not thinking about, oh, what's that emotion? What is that? Oh, well, I know what it is. So-and-so made me mad because they parked their car too close to my parking space. So that's what it is. So I'm going to go and tell so-and-so off, or just leave a little note on their windshield, and then I'll feel better. But it's their fault. So instead, we investigate. We don't try to think our way out of that emotion. And I always just think of meditation. We just relax and we just go just like down into ourselves. We just relax into ourselves and just observe. And we let our body, let it speak to us and tell us more. Because it's got our history, you know, it's all there. And the Buddha always said, everything we need to learn is in this body, from the top of our head to the bottom of our toes. So we investigate in a way that is not our linear or creative thinking, no matter how wonderful that is. We just let our body tell us. And then the last step, the N, and remember it's R-A-I-N, the last step is non-identification. So we've looked at that emotion, we've investigated it, we've accepted it, and we've acknowledged it, and we've investigated it, but now we can let it go. That emotion is not who we are. And the favorite phrase that all the students in all my classes, because I use it so much, the Buddha it was always saying, not me, not mine, not who I am. So those are the things everything that's not me, that's not mine, it's not who I am, those are things we don't have to be all upset and worried about. Those are things that are not my business. And that's pretty much everything. That includes our children, you know, our spouse, that includes our good friends. And those emotions, it includes our emotions. Our emotions are not who we are. Our emotions are those clouds passing through our mind. Our mind is clear, and the emotions we have, those strong feelings, those disturbing emotions, even the passionate, loving, those passionate emotions, they're either things that we want to cling to and never let go of, or the things that we just get really upset about and are really bad to us. Those are all those emotional states that come and go. And it's not until we grab onto them and cling to them and say, this is me. And think of people you know who will say, and this is happens a lot, like at the end of the day, you know, they may have come to talk to someone at the temple. They may have gone to their therapist. They may have talked and talked and talked about something. At the end of the day, they'll say, well, I guess I'm just an angry person. That's just how I am. So my family's going to have to just deal with it. And they've been talking all day about how can I deal with my anger. But after the talk is all done, they're still identifying with that. Or they're identifying with a quality. Like, I hate conflict, so I'm not gonna talk to so-and-so about, you know, this problem we have. I'm just going to put up with it. That's just how I am. And we know that usually means you'll just put up with it until you take an axe out of a woodshed and chop the person up. But we're somehow identifying with a quality or a personality, might be a personality defect, but it's just something that we identify with and say that that's mine. Whether we like it, we might cling to it because we liked, even if it's a bad quality, even if it's that, well, I'm just an angry person. Sometimes we like to cling to that because that's comfortable. That's our habit. That's what we've always known. That may be something that was from the family we were raised in. from the people we chose to put in our lives. So it might be a quality that is just comfortable. It might be painful, cause grief, cause, it may hurt a lot of people and hurt us a lot. But if it's more comfortable than changing, we'll cling to that. So the non-attachment, non-identification with that emotion is, that's where the real relief comes. We can look at it, we can see, but the only way we'll get rid of it is when we can say, that's not me, that's not mine, that's not who I am. And then eventually that disturbance will just can leave us. We can be done with it. And the Buddha always talked about, and I know most teachers do, about we can root out those deep negative emotions, those deep negative qualities in ourselves, that those can be pulled out by the root, that we don't have to always feel like, oh, that's always there. Because as we learn more about mindfulness and loving kindness and about, ethical behavior and how it all ties together, those other qualities will leave because they just fall away because we're filling ourselves up with the different qualities, the qualities of all the virtues that we're working with, and all patience and determination and intention, and all of those good qualities will just let the other ones fall away. So some people say, well, I've always been this way, so I can't change. But that's just a choice, because we can change and we can transform. And we begin, I've got to watch my time, we begin by doing it. I think the best practice for doing that is loving kindness. So loving kindness specifically transforms our minds, because like I said at the beginning, we're letting go of those self-critical, self-judgment thoughts towards ourselves. And we're befriending ourselves, feeling okay towards our imperfect self. We're acknowledging and accepting that ourselves. And when we can do that, if we can do that to ourselves, we can do it with we gradually work out. It's like rippling out. So we just ripple out until we're able to send loving kindness, which means loving kindness means we've sending out goodwill, because we've let go of criticism and judgment, and most of all thinking we can fix everything. And we often think we could fix the world, And what we have to remember is the world is the world, and a lot of it is stuff we can't fix, because the only thing we can't fix ourselves. All we can do is transform ourselves. It's everything we do. We start with ourselves, and we stick with ourselves, because the most we do to help other people is what they see from us and what they experience from us. And so all of our behavior, our speech, just our being becomes loving kindness. And that's what radiates out to other people. And then that can affect their behavior. And then that ripples out further. So we don't have to go any further than stopping in our tracks and sending loving kindness to ourselves, and changing every bit of everything about our relationship to self to change the world. So the world is samsara. That's just, the world is, this is what we're here for, is to deal with the way the world is. And the world may never be full of peace, but what we're doing is trying to find peace in an unwell world, right? In an unhappy, turbulent world, we find peace within ourselves. And then that's how we extend peace to others. So let's do a little sitting practice, and then we'll have time for questions or answers. You may have answers. So just sit comfortably. Now, if you're used to sitting on a cushion or the floor, then practice sitting in a chair. And some people can cross their legs on a chair, which I think is great. It's okay if you want to do that. I've never been able to do that. I don't think even as a little kid I could do that. So if you're sitting with your feet on the floor, you want both feet on the floor. And then just let your hands be comfortable in your lap. It doesn't matter. You know, some people have like they use different mudras, and those are all those hand things you see people do and you see on statues of the Buddha. But you can put your palms down, or you can put your palms up, hands together. Really, we just want our shoulders to not be carrying the weight of our arms. So let your hands be comfortable for you in your lap. What you want to do is have your back straight. And so becoming comfortable with your posture will be to let your back be straight, and then find a way to align your back so your spine is just, each vertebra is resting on the one below it. And as you relax, even the muscles holding your spine erect can relax, because you're in a posture that really is comfortable for you. And then in our practice, we close our eyes. If you can leave them open, that's up to you. And begin by taking maybe 3 deep breaths in and out. And that just helps ground you. And after you've done that and you feel all grounded, just begin to breathe your natural breath. Just your own breathing in and out. Doesn't have to be deep. And anytime you need to readjust your posture, that's perfectly okay. And as you sit and breathe, the main instruction is just to relax. Let your body relax. On the exhale of your breath, you can feel your shoulders drop. Relax and let go. You may have had a rush day coming here from work, or a quick dinner. Now you can just let everything go. Be aware of those senses, your sense doors picking up so much, even in this quiet space. You can hear sounds from the building and from the computer, little hums, little sounds. You can feel the temperature of the cool air on your skin. Feel the floor beneath your feet, the pressure of the seat and the arms of the chairs against your body. You can pick up fragrances. You have a taste in your mouth, maybe from the tea you drank, or maybe your mouth feels dry. And even with your eyes closed, you have light coming through your closed eyelids. just be aware of how much is going on with those, your senses and everything almost bombarding you. Be aware of it all. It doesn't have to distract us when we practice. Some practices we can deal completely with all of those experiences, all of those senses and what's going on with them. But let's begin with loving kindness. We always begin with ourselves because we know when we learn to love ourselves, then we're capable of loving others. May I be free from mental and physical suffering, and may I be safe from harm. May I be well. May I be peaceful. May I be happy. Feel unconditional acceptance towards yourself. Let the negative voices just take a break. Just let go. Let go of that. Recognize how pure your true nature is, how rare this human life is. How wonderful it is to have this human experience, because there's so much we can learn, and our consciousness allows us to learn and grow from everything that happens to us. Now extend these same feelings and thoughts out to the people you love, the people you feel most connected to. It might be your family, your close friends. May all my loved ones be free from mental and physical suffering, and may they be safe from harm. May all my loved ones be well and happy and peaceful. Sometimes our loved ones are the most difficult ones. These are the relationships that seem to be intense, usually because we're trying to change our loved ones or they're trying to change us. We have expectations. So just for now, let go of all those expectations and feel unconditional acceptance for all of your loved ones. Just the way they are right at this moment. see their faces. Now extend out even further. And think of all the people that you've ever known in your life. Maybe you've only seen them once. Maybe you've just had a brief encounter with someone. We certainly can't remember all of them, but just imagine all the people who have been in your life, one way or another. Send all of these people thoughts of goodwill, thoughts of peace. Whether you remember them fondly or barely remember them at all, may all the people I have ever known in my life be free from suffering, be safe from harm, and may each one of them be well and happy and peaceful. Now allow that quality of loving kindness to just extend out from you, just like rays from the sun. Just become the quality of loving kindness, letting it move out in all directions from you. Sending loving kindness out to all living beings, human beings and non-human beings, beings born and not yet born. Include all creatures and animals and beings that we never see, and people of all different countries and all different worlds. May all living beings be free from mental and physical suffering, and may all living beings be safe from harm. May they be free from fear and worry and anxiety, free from hunger and thirst and the extremes of the weather. May all living beings be able to take care of themselves and still have some ease in their lives. And may they know peace. Now we'll move into mindfulness practice. And just do that when you're ready, by shifting the focus of your attention to your breath. And just begin to watch yourself. Observe yourself breathing in and out. Keep relaxing your body. Letting go. Let your focus be like a butterfly, very light. Now thoughts will arise, and that's okay, don't repress your thoughts, but don't grab on to your thoughts. So we're not clinging to our thoughts, but we're also not pushing them away. This is acknowledging them, recognizing them. But we're just letting them come, and then we're allowing them to go. Let your thoughts be like the clouds passing through the clear sky. Let them come, let them go. Now, the most important second of your meditation is if you notice your mind is distracted, that your monkey mind is off and running. So at that second, you notice your thinking is taken over. But at that very second, you can also decide to let go of the thinking and come back to your breath. And you can do that 1,001 times. And that's the ideal way to meditate. We just catch our minds as they're beginning to drift away or run away. And we just let go of the thought and come back to our breath. And once again, relax into our breath. Now, when you're ready, you can just open your eyes. May peace be with you. May you be well. May you be happy. And may you be peaceful.
When do you use the thinking mind?
When do you use it?
When do you use it?
When do I use it? Way too much. I'm thinking a lot. I mean, that's our favorite thing to do, usually. But what I have learned, I do it a lot less. Before I started meditating, I was very aware of that, like a rat on that little thing that turns around. My mind worked like that. It was always compulsively. If I had a problem or with what I thought was a problem, I would just think about it all the time. Just think. And then I'd dream. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, maybe. So I was thinking all the time. And I thought that was normal. And it sort of is normal. I mean, a lot of times people will say, you know, I can't meditate because my mind races and I think too much. Well, that's the nature of the mind. So I guess for me, what changed the most when I began to practice, and it changed pretty quickly, was that that rat in my head is not there anymore running on that little wheel. So more and more, and the more I practice, and it's certainly pretty active all the time, but it's not that crazy thinking all the time. I'm much more able to let things go, knowing that when it's time to make a decision about something, I'll be able to make a decision. Much, much better at not worrying about the future. But then there'll be times when something comes up and, you know, I worry about it for a while, but then I can say, whoa, wait a minute, and come back to my practice. Not fretting as much about things that I've done in the past. And so it's very gradual, but some of it seems like sometimes I can't believe that I don't do that constant thinking. I can drop it. I can let it go sometimes.
There's a question from someone through the internet. Can you talk about self-acceptance and bad or destructive habits?
Well, that's one that we're all dealing with all the time. And I think the more we progress on our path, if we have a spiritual path or a path we want our life to take, the further along we go, the more we see things that we'd like to transform. So it never stops, you know, we never get to a place where it's like, oh, now I'm perfect. So dealing with bad habits and bad habits and
destructive.
Yeah, that's one thing that we're working with in the Refuge Recovery Group, which is wonderful kind of gathering of people who practice meditation and want to work their issues, their bad habits, and their destructive behaviors. They want to find practical applications using the teachings of the Buddha. They're not necessarily Buddhist, but people who really appreciate the teachings of the Buddha. So we use the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. That becomes the 12 steps in Refuge Recovery. So there's always time with each time people are together, there's time for sharing. And that means people can talk about what's going on with them. So someone might start out identifying themselves as, I'm a recovering alcoholic. And maybe they've had 20 years of sobriety, but they're always dealing with things that they see in their lives that are their that they're connected. They're all connected. The one habit or the addiction that they felt they had to one substance can often be replaced with another substance that's less harmful or less, you know, it's less destructive, physically destructive, but nonetheless, it's a manifestation of a certain thing that's sort of eating away at them or keeping them from being where they want to be. So the thing it takes more than anything else is that constant acknowledgement of it and not being afraid to look and see. I know for me, my favorite issue is my favorite addiction or issue the place I turn to the most when I want to not deal with something is food. So I know it doesn't matter. And I thought, I hate to say this, but I will. When I ordained, I really had in my head, one of the side effects will be that I'll just automatically lose weight and won't think about food, because monastics are try to be very aware of what we eat and when we eat. And that, darn it, that didn't happen. You know, I managed to bring myself right along with me. So it's still something I have to continually, you know, I think I have it under control, and then I realize it's not under control. And so it's always something I have to work with. And so when we talk about bad habits can be addictions. It's just like our thinking, you know, we're all in recovery. Our life is being in recovery. So I think it takes a great deal of determination, and it has to take, just like finding time to meditate every day, dealing with those things has to be very conscious. We have to have the intention to work with it and see it clearly for what it is. And then we have to keep coming back to that. And if it's a bad enough habit, we need to find a group. I mean, some people find their meditation group without it being a recovery group has given them the focus that they needed to deal with that. And then some of us, that habit's strong enough that we want a recovery group that we do in addition to that. And then we still have to go home and deal with it, right? So it all comes back down to that relationship we have with ourselves. And if we're doing it with loving kindness, we have to keep loving ourselves even while we're working with an active, let's call it an addiction or an active issue. We have to keep loving ourselves and not wake up the next day and think, well, I'm hopeless. I'm going to be biting my fingernails all my life. You know, whatever it is, it's not, we still have to see this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. And I think that's what I would say is where we have to start and we have to keep coming back to.
Can you talk about how to do this maybe with children to help them get some of those negative thoughts out of their heads and stuff?
You know, there's a lot of good writing about working with children, because one thing that's good about the whole mindfulness movement and bringing it into the schools, it's really children just eat it up. So I know with little kids, you're talking about little ones or all. We have a class at the temple. It's like Sunday school would be, but we have Buddha kids and then Buddha youth for the older ones. And the volunteers who teach the classes are wonderful. The kids, even the little ones, love to, okay, we're going to meditate. So if they do it for a minute, that's great. And they love to do it. I mean, they love to get in the posture, and we have these big sort of beanbag things. And they love just having that little bit of quiet, and they do little crafts. And the favorite thing they do, and all the grown-ups want to go home and do it, they take little bell jars or some kind of jar with a lid that's secure, and put water and a little bit of soap and maybe a drop or two of glycerin in it, and then put a bunch of glitter in it. So they shake it up, and then they tell the kids, now when you go home, if you get in a bad mood or you get angry at someone or upset, or maybe you're mad at your mom or your sister or your brother, go and find your quiet place and then shake your jar and then turn it over and see how clouded it is. It's not clear water. See all that glitter in it? It's all rushing around. And what you can do is sit and watch that and just watch and see how long it takes the glitter to settle down. And that can help you. And so it gives them, they can actually watch how it becomes clear, and they've been quiet and they've been mindful. It's a wonderful mindfulness tool. So all the grown-ups are like, because the kids come and tell everybody about their project, all the grown-ups are like, now how much glycerin do you put in there? So you can do, and children love that, teenagers love it. So there are little steps, and you can just incorporate it in your own life, and then they'll take an interest in it. And so you have to do it, they have to see it in you. They have to see you become calmer and you become more patient and happier. And then whatever you're doing is gonna look pretty good to them. But I think the idea of sitting quietly, you don't even have to call it meditation. I have a friend, and we have a meditation group in a senior apartment. But the group has stayed very small. But I do it every 2 weeks. And one person in the group says, well, you know, unless you're offering refreshments and coffee, you're not going to get people to come. And then the other woman says, well, you know, if we called it something other than meditation, then people would come. So we just keep doing it. You know, that's fine. It doesn't matter how many people come. But you might not want to call it meditation. But you might want to talk about having, you know, the little kid, we talk about quiet time. But you find just little things you can work into their lives and they are very proud. They're very happy they talk about, when they go into Buddha Kids, they'll talk about, okay, the teachers say, how did you use your jars this week at all? Or did you get upset with anybody at school this week? And did that jar help at all? And they'll have examples about things that happened at school. They start wanting to bring those examples. Or they'll start noticing if we're talking about bullies. They'll start thinking about, you might talk to them about ways they can help someone if someone's being a bully, or the way they can become friends with the bully and maybe help the bully. Then they have great children's books that have, you know, that are full of those principles. So it's fun. One of our volunteers is getting the mindfulness certification for education. And it's very long and very expensive, but she has great material for the kids. So does that help at all?
I notice in the past, trying to meditate, I do best with guided meditation, mm-hmm. like what you offered. And I question when we were doing loving kindness for all the people that we had been. I almost felt like that was monkey mind. I mean, it felt mm-hmm. like a beautiful monkey mind. Felt very prayerful, and I felt really good about it. But my question is that monkey mind when...
You know, that could very well be. And I've just done that particular think about all the people you've ever known a few times. But that's a really good point, because it would be a very easy group to get off into, like, memory lane. It's hard enough when you do your loved ones. And I've had people tell me, oh, I start thinking about all my family members, and then I think about this cousin and that cousin, and I've had people say that becomes monkey mind for them. And so if it is, if it's too much, too many people, just
okay, this week, today when I'm doing loving kindness, all week long, I'm going to have it just be four people in my